Thank you very much, and hello everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be in the world. I'm here in FTI's office in London. I have with me Tim Bushell, who is Petromitad's Technical Non-Executive Director. And how we are going to structure this is I will use the most recently published corporate presentation just to run through, not in huge amount of detail, but just to run through some of the slides in that presentation. And then we'll hand over for Q&A and follow up. So with that, I'll get started. I'm not going to go through the who Petromitad is and what it is we do, because I'm assuming that everybody on the call is reasonably familiar with that. Where I'll start is on slide number 4 from the most recently published corporate presentation, with the corporate overview, just to update you on what has happened most recently. As everybody will be aware, we raised money in 2018 to do a multi-well program. The plan was for 6 wells in through 2018-2019. We have, in fact, now drilled 5 wells and tested 1. And as you will have been following and seen in our press statements, the Heron 1 well was an oil discovery in the eastern part of Mongolia in Block 20. And I will focus on that today, although I will also talk you through the results of the other 2 wells that we drilled during 2019. So 2018 was focused out in the west of Mongolia, 2019 in the east, close to the producing area of the main production of Mongolia, which is operated by PetroChina and is immediately to the north of our Block 20. Heron 1, the discovery we made, we had prognosed it as an extension and therefore an appraisal of an oil field in the PetroChina acreage called 1946. And I'll talk you through how the results came out and we believe confirmed that pre-drill prognosis. The well results also support and may enhance our resource estimate for Heron, which was 25 million barrels recoverable pre-drill. And the well is located very close to PetroChina's infrastructure, 20 kilometers from their main processing hub, about 5 kilometers from their oil export road, and about 1 kilometer away from electrical power that they have in their field area. So although Mongolia is a big place and can be quite remote, we are situated right next to existing infrastructure, giving us the chance to put wells on stream a well at a time and hopefully start producing very soon. And I'll talk you through what we need to be able to do that. I will also talk you through where the follow-up potential is in the proven basin that we have now defined as extending well into the north of Block 20, and talk you through the process we're going through at the moment to secure an exploitation license for Block 20, recognizing that the exploration period for the block expires in early July of next year. So to retain tenure to the land and to the discovery we have made and to the surrounding upside potential, we need to get an exploitation license. We're also looking at appraisal and development plans for the field and for the step-out exploration on Block 20. We are securing permits and we're looking at, as I say, development options, but also funding options to take this through to production as quickly as we can. In the meantime, we still hold our blocks in Western Mongolia, and we want to focus in 2020 on getting the Heron field on stream and getting some development wells drilled. So that will be our focus. We are seeking, in conversation with the Mongolian government, some more time on the Western Mongolian acreage so that we are able to drill on in Western Mongolia again, very likely in 2020. Those discussions are ongoing, and I will summarize those in the latter part of the presentation. So on slide number 5, the Mongolia oil industry update. This is not particularly new from the last time it was presented. It's the same daily production curve that was on there the last time. And obviously the map hasn't changed very much. What I would point out though is that the Mongol refinery shown on the map, this is the refinery that Mongolia is building using a soft loan from the Indian government. That work is advancing on that. And in a recent meeting I had with high-level government officials, they said that that project was now, quote, unstoppable, unquote. I think they were saying that because there's an election coming in Mongolia next year, and this government has pushed the Mongolian refinery very, very hard. I think they're implying that if there's a change in a change in government, then the new government won't stop it because a lot of the money has already been invested, was the point they were trying to make. And their suggestion was that the refinery would be on stream in 3 to 4 years. They also did say that they had agreement from PetroChina that they would reroute their oil export from the route that takes it into China to be refined to the Mongol refinery. So that has moved along. Apparently the EPC contract has been awarded, and the infrastructure projects for rail link, road link and power links are either finished or near finished, according to those government sources. The only other thing that's new here is that Petromitad recently received the Leading Explorer Award from the Mongolian government. Currently, there's probably only one really active explorer in Mongolia, and that's us. So it's not against a particularly big field there, but we were pleased to receive it. And this was actually on the occasion of the 80th anniversary of the founding of the geology sector in Mongolia was the reason for these awards. So we were pleased to receive that. And fair to say that the Heron discovery has been very well received by the Mongolian government. There was were a number of people saying, why are we building an oil refinery when our production is going down and nobody's exploring for oil, let alone finding any? So a new discovery, as it's looked upon by the Mongolian government, was absolutely the right thing to do at the time we have done it. And we've been able to get quite a lot of face time with various offices of government just to make sure everybody understands what we need to do next and how quickly we need to do it. And so I will talk you through that as we go. Slide number six, I don't think I need to go through this anymore. I'm a firm believer that the geology of northern China, which is highly petroliferous, doesn't stop at the border with Mongolia, and the basins of southern Mongolia, although largely undrilled, are, I would believe, highly prospective because the geology is the same as those basins producing to the south. And you can see in amongst the yellow and green on there, highlighted in orange, are our areas, block 20 over in the east and blocks 4 and 5 in the west. I'll start talking about block 20, where we've been active in 2019, and then we'll talk a little bit about block number 5. So slide number 7 is a picture of the sun coming up over the rig at Heron number 1. And our activity is summarized on the next slide, which is slide 8, although the number seems to have fallen off. So we drilled 3 wells in 2019 with a Mongolian/Chinese drilling contractor. We drilled Red Deer number 1 in the Asgat Sag Basin of Southern Block 20, the first well ever drilled in that area or in that basin. And with a rig from DQE, which is a sister company or an affiliate of PetroChina, we drilled the Heron 1 well and the Gazelle 1 well, and then we brought in a DQE testing rig to do Heron 1 testing. We were able to complete the all 3 wells with no lost time accidents. We did have a few interruptions, as you will have noticed if you've been reading the regulatory notices we've sent out. We had a little bit of problem with land access early in the program. That's a problem that the government needs to fix. They still haven't, but we were able to complete our operations through convincing everybody that as the problem wasn't our fault, we should be allowed to get on and finish our work program. We've been told by the regulator they expect to finish the sorting out that problem within the next month or two. So for operations in 2020, they are saying that everything should be okay, but we are pushing to make sure that's the case because you don't want to be held up when you've mobilized equipment to the field. As regards results of the wells overall, Heron 1, obviously a discovery. We got a good test rate that I will talk you through. Gazelle 1, a bit disappointing. The reservoir section was less well developed than we were expecting. We did have 2 pay zones totaling about 3 meters of pay in very good quality sands, And we suspended Gazelle in rather the same way that we had suspended Heron at the time, to keep as potentially a well that we could test or perhaps sidetrack, depending on where the upside potential on Gazelle is. And I'll talk you through that. Red Deer 1, I will show you a strip log of Red Deer 1. It was plugged and abandoned with oil shows, some quite interesting oil shows, but unfortunately nothing in the major reservoir, which was well developed and good quality, but didn't have any oil in it. But the presence of a petroleum system is borne out by the oil shows shallower in the well. We successfully tested Heron 1 during October, two tests, the second of which achieved a near best flow rate for the basin. So that was very pleasing, given that it's one of the deeper wells in the basin as well. We're now doing various post-well analyses, and we have been for some time talking to the government about how we would quickly get our exploitation license. And now that they can see we have a reason to keep that land, those discussions are now going on with some urgency. And I'll explain why that is as we go through. On slide number 9, this just summarizes the situation as regards Heron and its relationship with the 1946 field in Block 19. So the horizontal red line is the block boundary, Block 19 to the north, Block 20 to the south. The culmination called 1946 has actually been developed by PetroChina, and in fact they were drilling new wells on it during our drilling campaign. 1946-1 and 46-3 have had, as far as we can tell, one additional well each drilled on them over the last 10 years, but it's not an area that PetroChina has yet put into commercial production. Anyway, Heron 1 came in on prognosis at the top of the reservoir. We had an oil down to giving us about 77 meters gross of the primary reservoir target with oil shows. And that oil down to is consistent with the oil water contact recorded from the 1946 wells. And so no surprises there. The 3D seismic that basically confirmed the structure was the same has been borne out by those well results. And so the total area of the structure is about 21 square kilometers. 62% of that lies in Block 20. And the structural culmination also lies in Block 20. As you go south from Heron, you come up dip quite quickly into the major bounding fault. And so if the sands extend further south, which we expect they will, and if they're in pressure communication, which by analogy with 1946, they probably will be, then to the south of Heron 1, we could expect to have quite a large oil column behind us, which actually might help improve flow rates. And as we come shallower, the reservoir may also improve. Our pre-drill estimate of reserves for Heron was 25 million barrels, and that was based on parameters from Block 19. So the fact that we got a much better production rate than we were expecting perhaps tells us we've been a little bit conservative. But obviously, it's only one well so far, so we're not going to get carried away by that, but we're going to be at least encouraged. The following slide, slide 10, once again without a number, it just summarizes in strip log form the Heron 1 results. No real surprise here. We started to see gas in the mud from around about 1600 meters, which was kind of as expected. We had all of the components of the background gas that that were expected and that the mud logging unit could actually measure. And as I said, we hit the top of the reservoir a few meters shallow to prognosis and had an oil down to 77 meters below that. And on the logs, we had a 22 meter gross interval of that 77 meters that was clearly of better quality than we had expected and better quality than one generally sees in this particular reservoir in the area. So if you have a look at slide 11, that gives a little bit of a close-up of what the logs look like. Generally, the chattery nature of these logs is common in the basin, and you don't often see the resistivity deflections to the right that suggest that you've got good porosity permeability. These tend to be thin sands, not very permeable, a reasonable level of porosity, but not particularly permeable. So our eyes were immediately attracted to the zones that have been labeled A, B, and C. when we were drilling the well, Zone A actually surprised everybody, including the drilling contractor who's drilled many hundreds of wells in this basin, because we started to lose mud to the formation, which is suggestive that the formation is permeable. And as I say, that was a bit of a surprise. But that gave us some hope that when we tried to do things the other way and get something out of the formation, then there was a good chance it was going to come out. We started our test program with Zone C, a relatively thin zone, but the sands looked good from the well site descriptions and the log data looked okay. So we perforated just under 3 meters of this. It turned out to be tight. It didn't flow, although it did produce, or it did. We did reverse out about 60 liters of oil in the test string when we recovered the tools, 46 API. At the time, we thought, well, kind of as we'd expected we might have to do, we would have to stimulate this zone with a frack. So we had the fracking contractor standing by waiting to come in and do that. And that was going to be dependent on DST number two. We didn't test Zone B because we expected a similar result to the Zone C result. And we moved up to Zone A and perforated just under 11 meters of sandstone there. And this one on flow, its maximum flow that it achieved was 821 barrels a day. The main flow period, which was run for around about 30 hours, was 200 barrels a day on a third of an inch choke, 46 degree API oil, which is the lightest oil in the basin, but only by about 0.25 of an API degree. So they've seen 45 API before. 46, though, as I say, is just, by a slight margin the highest API seen. Wellhead flowing pressure of 250 psi. So naturally flowing, there's not that many wells in this basin that achieve that. Perhaps because we are deeper in the basin and maybe it's a little bit more gassy than the wells in shallower in the basin, maybe there was a little bit of component of associated gas lift that was coming along there. But overall, a very, very good result, a test rate much higher than we dared expect, and oil quality that just on visual inspection so far and a rudimentary analysis that was done in the field looks, as we would expect, very similar to the 1946 oil that the PetroChina has been producing. We are now organizing for the export of the oil to do a proper assay to give us all of its details and all of its contents, because obviously that's going to play a role in what we might do with the oil point forward. So if you turn to slide number 12, this just summarizes the Heron area upside. So you can see there Heron is colored in green with its adjoining field 1946 to the north. The Gazelle well, we think that Gazelle had less sand than we were expecting, and 1946-1 has quite a lot of sand, some of it reasonably good quality. So somewhere between those two locations, there may be some form of trap being developed that perhaps Gazelle 1 is the absolute up-dip limit of. So perhaps to the north of Gazelle 1, we may be able to find the thin sands, the thin pay sands we found in the well thickening as we go to the north. So we're going to be working that up and seeing what that means for the potential of Gazelle or the sands between Gazelle and 1946-1. And as I said, that well has been cased to bottom and suspended. That was a zero-cost operation for us because the lump sum cost for drilling these wells includes casing to bottom. So had we not cased the well, it would have just been a present of casing to DQE. So we ran it, so that well has now been suspended. And that also helps us with our argument with the government to say that for the exploitation area that we want to keep, we don't just want to keep the area of the Heron discovery. We would like to keep the Heron area, the Gazelle area, and the extension of the Tamsag Basin into Block 20, because there is additional upside that we would like to exploit. Now, under the legislation in Mongolia, there's no definition as to what you get to keep when you apply for an exploitation license. Obviously, the government doesn't want us to be greedy. They don't want us to take huge areas of land. But at the same time, they understand that it's a lot easier for us to have an economic development if we can not only develop what we found, but also have the chance to drill step out near-field exploration prospects. We're in discussion with them to retain an area that is going to be 1% or 2% of the original block size of Block 20, and it will be focused in this proven area. By comparison with Block 19, for example, PetroChina retained about 8.5% of their original block size. We're arguing that we're not being greedy at all. The upside potential that we've defined here, there's a number of fault terraces to the south and to the east of Heron that are high-graded. The issue here is, do they have access to source? Can you get across that big black fault that's shown on the map into those fault terraces? Well, you see there is a well on there called DT4, which is one of the wells that Petromitad drilled back in 2011. That well did have live oil in it. When it was tested, it did reverse out a few barrels of oil. Although there, we don't believe there's very much by way of overall trap closure. There is a feature to the north that we've called E and another one called F. Some of these are relatively small, but cumulatively, they add up to effectively seven structures. We also have the large southerly pinch out of the Lower Sagan reservoir on the southern extreme of the Tamsag Basin, which we've labeled in as H. Not to say that it's all necessarily one big pinch out trap. We don't have 3D coverage over the entirety of this area. That would be something that sometime in the future we would need. Our assessment of the potential, the follow-up to Heron, where we think we have 25 million barrels recoverable or maybe a little more in the feature itself, is that in these features numbered A through H, we have of the range of 50-85 million barrels of upside. Obviously in a proven basin, so the wells drilled in here, whilst not exploration wells are never risk-free, would have a pretty good chance of success. As you come south, they become shallower and therefore drilling costs are lower. Slide 13 just summarizes what the pinch out trap looks like. When I was showing this to somebody yesterday, they were a bit of a North Sea aficionado, and they remembered the Buzzard field, which is a similar pinch out trap into a basin closing embayment. Basically, if that fairway is plumbed into oil generation, which it certainly seems to be here, and Heron has proven that, then once it goes up dip into the southern embayment and pinches out on basement, it's got nowhere else to go. It gets trapped in those sands as they shale out. That can potentially be quite a large accumulation or a series of accumulations, depending exactly on the basin architecture, potential for big column, and also relatively shallow targets. We'd be looking for very cheap ways of determining whether there was oil in those features and then following up with proper wells and proper developments. Some nice looking upside to follow on from Heron. What we need to do now, and the negotiation we're having with the government, is getting that exploitation license, agreeing how big it's going to be, and getting it as quickly as possible. Now, obviously, we want to get that as quickly as possible because we want to make sure we have tenure to the land beyond July of next year. Using the momentum that the discovery has given us, I met with the government to celebrate the fact that we'd made a discovery and told them that I would like the exploitation license before the end of 2019. They didn't throw me out. They didn't laugh. They did kind of have that's a bit quick look on their face because the bureaucracy does take some time to move. So long as we can get it by the end of the first quarter, then that would allow us to do work in 2020, which is my goal. I don't want 2020 to be a wasted year waiting on approvals. We're pushing quite hard to try and agree the area that we are going to be allowed to keep and to get that approval in hand so that we can move forward with a 2020 program. As part of that, we've already started the permitting process for our 2020 activities as we think they may be, which would be putting Heron 1 on stream and drilling some appraisal/development wells on the Heron field, and as they come in, putting each one of those on stream as well, and therefore starting to generate some revenue for Petromitad, which is kind of long overdue. I'll come back to that in a moment, to the commercialization of the discovery, and talk you through what we're thinking in terms of options and funding and that kind of stuff. If we have a look at just the next two slides, which would be slides 14 and 15, the Gazelle One results summary and then the Red Deer summary. Gazelle, pretty much on prognosis apart from at the primary target, although fair to say that with only a little bit of tweak in the velocity model, you can actually explain why, if we're as far out as we thought we were, we can explain why it is. It doesn't mean any massive mispick. It just means a little bit of a difference in velocity model. We saw the petroleum system picking up as we drilled on down with the occurrence of background gas. No surprise there. But when we finally did get to the Lower Sagan-Sav formation, as I mentioned, not as sandy as we were expecting it to be, and we had 3 meters of pay in two good quality sands as we drilled down, but then sands below that, the few that there were water wet. So as I said, we have cased the well to bottom for potentially future testing or sidetracking once we've done the follow-up work. Obviously, the presence of oil proves further that there's an extension of the oil fairway into Block 20. The pay may thicken northwards as we go towards 1946-1, because certainly that well does have more sandy nature of the Lower Sagan-Sav. And the fact that we've got a variability in the reservoir does highlight the potential for combination structural stratigraphic traps like those pinch outs that I showed on the previous slide. So yeah, a little, I was disappointed with Gazelle because we had high hopes for good reservoir quality, therefore less reservoir was a bit of a surprise, and also for more pay than we saw in the well. But potentially some upside to the north, so we haven't given up on it at this stage. Red Deer, the next slide. As I mentioned, this was the first well in the Åsgard-Sag Basin in the southern part of Block 20. The pre-drill risks were all on structure and is there a source rock in the basin and is the basin deep enough to be generating hydrocarbons? The basin is relatively shallow, so that was a worry beforehand, but these basins have probably been more deeply buried than they currently are and have been uplifted in more recent geological time. As you can see from the drilling gas component analysis, we did have quite a lot of drilling gas within the well. And then from about 1150 on down, although we were in wholly shaley rocks, we did start to see in the mud quite good indications of oil, quite bright fluorescence within the mud. To the extent that we actually worried that this was some form of contamination. We weren't seeing sands with oil in them, we were just drilling through shales, but suddenly we had quite a lot of fluorescence in the mud. So we did interrogate the rig hands to make sure nobody had spilled anything in the mud. When we did the analysis, obviously we collected samples and we've done the analysis now. This is actually naturally occurring hydrocarbons. So quite shallow in the basin, shallower than our primary objective, there appears to be a working petroleum source. And perhaps that highlights the potential for recently generated structures and the shallower reservoirs, the likes of which we saw around about the 500 to 800 meter mark. Maybe that's a target for the flanks of the Åsgard-Sag Basin rather than the Red Deer Basin Center fault-bound enclosure that we chased. Because when we got down to the Lower Sagan-Sav, it was there, it was well developed, but it was water-bearing. So that's a bit of a teaser. Now, we don't have, obviously with the exploration period running out on Red Deer, we don't have any grounds to argue with the government that we should be allowed to keep the area for exploitation because we haven't found anything to exploit. But it's an interesting result and one that we will use with the rest of our database to try and work out whether there would be anything to go back there for in future with, you know, a new exploration venture, should we decide to do so. So just a little bit on the commercialization and the 2020 work program, slides 16 and 17. 16 is a slide I've shown before. It just shows the layout of the infrastructure on Block 19 to the north. As I mentioned, 20 kilometers away from PetroChina's central processing facility where they have spare ullage. They have said they are interested in cooperating such that we can use that facility. And so we will be engaging with them as we plan to put Heron 1 on stream in 2020. We'll be talking through them with them what the commercial details for that will be. And as I mentioned, there's electrical power close by should we need that. Although we did have a naturally flowing well that flowed at a rate that a beam pump is probably not the solution that we would need. We might actually want to use some form of electrical submersible pump on Heron 1. So the fact that there is electricity in the area, that is good too. Anyway, there's some commercial arrangements to be made there, but at the same time, I don't want to be entering negotiations with our illustrious neighbour with no obvious alternatives. So we are looking at, and we've been talking to potential off-takers who might want to do something with Block 20 oil other than just ship it to China through the PetroChina facilities. Somebody has come up with an idea of shipping to Russian refineries by rail. So we're looking at that. We're also looking at the possibility of a mini refinery, at least a temporary solution of a mini skid-mounted refinery at Heron that would allow us to actually produce, or would allow somebody at least, to produce some refined products. As you'll be aware, one of our major shareholders and our founding shareholder, Petrovis, is the largest fuel distributor in Mongolia, and they would be quite keen, if it made economic sense, to be in charge of refining and distributing domestically produced, domestically refined oil. That would be a big positive for them, and would also save them a lot of trucking costs that they currently incur from bringing in product from Russia. So that is something we're looking at. These mini refineries are being used in some of the basins of northern China. And there is a company in China that we are talking to now about going to visit some of their facilities, get an idea of what's involved. And once we've got the assay of our oil, working out what actually that oil could produce if put through a facility like those mini refineries in terms of being able to work out the commercial potential of that. And these, depending on what we find over the next couple of months, these could be viable alternatives or they may not. But I don't want to be in the situation when we talk to PetroChina that they feel that they can scalp us on tariff prices, or if they want to do a deal by way of cooperating with us, that they're the only act in town and therefore they can set the price. So I do want to have some alternatives and possibilities up our sleeves. So if you look at the provisional 2020 work schedule, obviously this is currently contingent upon getting that exploitation license as quickly as we can. We've shown on here it taking the best part of the first quarter. And so long as we are able to do our permitting in parallel, then that should allow us in the second half of the year to be operating. And our operations would be focused upon getting Heron 1 on production. We've already chosen locations and we're trying to permit them now for Heron 2, 3 and 4, all of which are based on 3D seismic of the same quality that we were able to use for the Heron 1 well. And so that would be appraisal slash development drilling on Heron. So as I mentioned at the start, a bit of a change in focus, looking at 2020 as being the year of trying to get on stream and to start generating some revenue. Because in terms of the development economics here, 25 million barrels developed the way that Block 19 has tended to develop its resources would require something of the order of 60 producing wells if we take the average recovery per well that PetroChina has seemed to manage, although with better reservoir, particularly as we come south, maybe we can assume that it wouldn't be quite so many wells. Those wells are relatively cheap. PetroChina is able to knock them down for $1 million each or thereabouts. But that generates an NPV10 of around about $150 million. I apologize for anybody who's looking at one of these slides that still says barrels of oil at the end of that. It shouldn't. NPV10 of about $150 million of that field, assuming an investment of the order of $80 or $90 million to get there, and still a good rate of return. So obviously, if this was in the hands of somebody that had already been doing it, like PetroChina, then they could do that. Now, obviously, I don't want to go to market to try and raise $100 million to develop this. I don't want to dilute everybody down. So we're looking at alternatives that would allow us to start generating revenue that then would allow us to develop this field in a self-sustaining way. Obviously, it wouldn't be quite as valuable as spending a shed load of money up front and getting on full production as quickly as possible. But I think from a shareholder point of view, it's a more favorable way of doing things. The company becomes self-sustaining quite quickly and then can use the extra revenue it generates to be able to drill development wells it needs year by year to bring that production profile up. So we're looking at that at the moment. At the moment, I would say that a cash injection of $10 million, maybe $15 million to get that moving would probably be required. And we're looking at whether we can get some debt financing from Mongolian banks to start us on the way. Those conversations are going on and will be for the next few weeks. Hard to say how successful that will be, but obviously Mongolian banks don't have to overcome the country risk. They're already there. So they are looking to do things in Mongolia, and we're hopeful that they could be interested in this. For the international banking community, Heron is a little bit early stage for borrowing money against, but from a local perspective, perhaps not. The potential off-takers we're looking at have also said that they can potentially invest as partners, although we may be a little early stage for that too, but they can do prepayments for cargoes if we sign up for a decent length of deal, whereby then we can use their money to put in what facilities we need, and therefore we don't have to raise it. So we're looking at ways of getting to a sum of money to kickstart the development that is not just going out for more equity. It may result in a small equity component being needed, but at the moment, that's not our focus. We'd like to find a way of doing the maximum amount of this without needing to issue more shares and raise more equity that way. And it can quite quickly become cash positive for the company. If we're running at an overhead, including PSC license fees of somewhere between $3 and $4 million a year, then the net back from the oil under the favorable PSC terms is that if we're producing somewhere around 350 to 400 barrels a day, the company covers its overhead. And if we're producing double that, then we're producing $3 to $4 million of potentially disposable cash flow. And if you can build that up over a period of months, then you can see how we would be able to fund development wells on Heron, which, as we move to the south, will become shallower and therefore should become cheaper. So we'd be looking at reducing the cost of those wells. And maybe in cooperation with PetroChina, we'd be able to tag into their very low drilling costs, which they're able to do because they have effectively continuous drilling programs going on in Block 19 all the time. So that's how the work program looks for 2020. And as you can see, very, very focused on Block 20 itself. But I know there are many of our shareholders and investors who are still keen to see us doing operations in Western Mongolia, where for a relatively low cost, you can have some very, very high impact prospects to be drilled that you know are absolutely transformational, not only for Petromitad, but also for Mongolia as a country. Now, obviously, we drilled two wells in 2018, one in Block 4, Wild Horse number 1, and one in Block 5, Snow Leopard number 1. Wild Horse had a tiny oil show right on basement, but otherwise it has left us rather scratching our heads as to where to go next on Block 4. We're still working the data, but it is a bit of a struggle to know, other than to just drill at the intersection of two seismic lines, it is a bit of a struggle at the moment to know where to go, and we probably know that block and those basins better than anybody else. However, in Block 5, things are a little bit different in that we have, in the Snow Leopard well, you will recall, and there is a slide on page 20 which summarizes it, but I won't go through that one in detail, but Snow Leopard number 1 did find a working petroleum system. We had quite an influx of oil into the mud during the drilling of that well. We analyzed it, and yes, it's naturally occurring hydrocarbons, and from a source rock of the age that we were expecting. So that basin has a proven system within it, and it also has the Raptor Trend, which are three, possibly four, relatively shallow compressional anticlines, and we would very much like to drill one of those, Velociraptor, perhaps using a truck-mounted slim hole configuration to be able to get the well cost down into the $1.5 to $2 million range. And in the neighboring basin, the Tugruk Basin, this is the scene of our 3D seismic, where we were able to map the Fox prospect, and where we also have the core hole data that Petromitad acquired back in 2011, the TSC1 core that did find hydrocarbon staining over sandstones towards the base of that hole. So this also has a proven petroleum system. And we've done a reinterpretation of the 3D. It's obviously quite a complicated area, but that reinterpretation has generated some very interesting prospectivity. Not only do we still have the Fox prospect, but over the top of Fox, we now have a shallow prospect that actually appears to be have good components of four-way dip closure. This we are calling Fox Shallow at the moment, not particularly imaginative, but perhaps we'll come up with something else soon. And that has 10 to 40 million barrels of potential. But then we also have a series of targets at various depths in a number of prospects we've called Phoenix. We have kind of a westerly Phoenix area and an easterly Phoenix area. And Phoenix has the potential, whilst Velociraptor has about 201 million barrels of mean recoverable resource potential, Phoenix is about 230 with 130 of additional upside in West Phoenix. And we can test the concept of the Phoenix trap by hitting just the first couple of the two shallowest horizons, and we could do that with a similar slim hole rig. So what I'm looking at is, as I said at the start, we'd like to buy a little bit of time with the government so that we're not in the time bind that we currently are on Block 5, where at the moment it expires in July of 2021. So we've proposed to the government that we do a moratorium of 15 to 18 months from the start of January 2020 through until the end of winter in the start of 2021, and that would give us two drilling seasons, 2021 and 2022, to be able to drill in Block 5, and then I could foresee a program of two or three wells targeting potentially 500 million barrels of mean prospective resource, obviously in an area where chance of success is not as high as it is over in Block 20, but I'd hate to walk away from these and leave them for somebody else to find. So at the moment, that is our plan, and that is the discussion we have ongoing with the government. And bigger picture, we're also trying to encourage some other operators, some of the perhaps larger E&P companies from the West, to come and join us in new ventures in Mongolia. Obviously, we've been there for a while. We have a good database. We know the geology of the country quite well. So we've got our ideas and our eyes on a couple of areas that we could consider signing up as new PSCs. But I don't want to be in the situation where a company of limited financial resource, even if we are producing a few thousand barrels a day from Heron at that stage, relatively limited financial resource has to go to the equity market every time it wants to drill an exploration well. I'd rather like to bring in credible, highly qualified partners who've got some deep pockets. So we've started that conversation. As many of you will know, we ran a farm out exercise over the last number of years, and quite a few companies believe in the technical prospectivity of Mongolia. But actually, to get them to take the step of coming into new country entry is often a hard thing to do. Well, if we're a sensible and credible exploration operator for them, then they can have a soft country entry by that means. And that's the process we're following right now to see if there's anybody interested. Because, as I say, we do have some ideas of acreage we might sign, and see whether anybody is interested in that as a refreshment of the exploration hopper for Petromitad. So, in conclusion, slide 23. We've completed the 2019 drilling program, and as you'll be aware, the post-well studies are underway. Two discoveries, Gazelle, a minor discovery, Heron 1, looking to have good commercial potential and reserves potential above 25 million barrels in the structure on block. Near-field exploration prospects that we've worked up in that proven Tamsag Basin extension into our block, and now negotiating with the Mongolian government to agree the size of the area we're going to retain and to get it as quickly as we possibly can, so that in all the conversations we're having, be they partnership with PetroChina, or be they the likes of PetroChina getting involved, or off-takers financing some of our efforts, or banks loaning us money, obviously they'll all want to see that we've got tenure to the land, so that's very important to get that as quickly as we can. And I, as I said, would like to do an active work program in 2020, which could start around about the middle of the year if all these things go smoothly over the next few weeks and months to be able to move forward. Reviewing the partnering and funding and development options that we have, and the provisional program for Block 20 is get that license and then secure the acreage around Heron Gazelle and the upside, obtain all the permits in parallel, and then get moving with Heron appraisal drilling and putting wells on stream to generate ourselves some revenue. And the Western Mongolian acreage, negotiating for more time so that we can focus our efforts on 2020 for 2020 on Block 20, and then follow up with the high impact stuff thereafter. So with that, I think I will stop talking.